Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and this month we've got two podcasts for you. This is going to be one of our usual First Thursday podcasts, and by that I mean I'll be going over cases that have been decided within the last month, and we've got some pretty interesting ones to talk about. And then we're also releasing today a special podcast. And the special podcast is on the state of police unions today. Police unions in particular, public safety unions in general. And that special podcast is nothing more than me talking about the winds that are swirling around us right now. And what, from my perspective of having been in this business for decades, what it is police unions need to do in what is increasingly looking like a fight for survival. That more somber information will be in the other podcast. In this podcast, I want to talk about cases because as everything else goes on, courts continue to decide these cases that tell us what rights public employees have in the workplace. And I've got five cases, if I get to them all, I've got five cases that I want to talk to you about this month. The first is not a new principle at all, but it's one that's pretty important. And it actually raises a question that I think people have been asking about COVID-19. But first of all, let me get to the case, and then I'll talk about the COVID-19 link after I talk about the case. And the question in the case is, under what circumstances does the Americans with Disabilities Act require an employer to continue providing a reasonable accommodation of a modified job to a public safety employee? In this case, a police officer. And you'll see the answer from the court is the ADA doesn't really seem to obligate an employer to do so, provided the employer has the right reason. So what's this case about? It involves Crystal Scott, who's a police officer with the city of Detroit, Michigan. She suffered an awful lot of injuries over the term of her career. 2011, she fell downstairs while responding to a call on duty. In 2012, she was in scooter training on the job and she crashed her scooter into a metal barricade at low speed when an insect flew into her helmet and she reacted and then swerved to avoid hitting a bike. And anyway, scooter accident. Yeah. Also in 2012, she fell out of her chair and hit her head when the chair rolled out from under her. In 2013, she fell down some stairs when a knee gave out on her. And while she was getting treatment for this injury, she was diagnosed with a torn meniscus in her right knee. She also discovered she was pregnant and was told by the police department's medical staff that she could not be provided with treatment for her knee injury during her pregnancy. Apparently, the treatment was arthroscopy. That's one of those words I never get right. And that would require anesthetic and thus shouldn't be doing it during her pregnancy. And then in 2014, she got involved in a car accident, this time while off duty. With all that, Scott had been placed on restricted duty in the police department since 2012. And in fact, in 2014, she was put on something that's called permanent restricted duty. She was assigned most recently to work as an officer on what's known as the gun desk in the Detroit Police Department. That job involved clerical duties and matters related to gun registration, stolen firearms, background checks, firearms licenses, concealed weapon permits, that sort of thing. Well, then the police chief changed. We had a new police chief, James Craig, became chief in 2013, and he began to civilianize positions that had been traditionally performed by sworn law enforcement officers. He stated publicly he was, quote, totally opposed, end quote, to, quote, those officers who were permanently disabled staying in sworn positions. When someone says you can no longer work in the field as a police officer, you are permanently disabled, said Chief Craig. That's the trigger. Well, 2016, Scott is evaluated by a doctor who finds that she cannot perform 8 of the essential functions of the job with her various disabilities. What couldn't she do? She couldn't make an arrest. She couldn't navigate physical obstacles. She couldn't enter and exit vehicles quickly for emergency purposes. She couldn't perform patrol functions for long periods of time without rest. She couldn't move people or heavy objects as necessary. She couldn't pursue anybody. She couldn't physically, well, you get the drift, right? I don't need to go on. The city involuntarily retires Scott, giving her a duty disability retirement, but she wasn't happy with that. And she sued not under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but under Michigan's state equivalent to the ADA. And her allegations, very familiar ADA-type allegations, were that she was disabled and the department discriminated against her by failing to provide her with a reasonable accommodation. What reasonable accommodation does she want? She wants to stay at the gun desk. And she says, look, I've been working at this gun desk for years. I've done the job. I've done everything perfectly. My supervisor likes me. And I should be allowed to stay at the gun desk. And the Michigan Court of Appeals said, no, you shouldn't. And the court said, there's no genuine dispute of fact that Scott was unable to perform all of the 24 essential functions of a Detroit police officer. There's no dispute that Scott's requested accommodation, wanting to be placed on a gun desk, in the words of the court, did not and could not make her able to perform the 24 essential functions of a police officer. So, what the court is saying here, and other courts have said this in both police and fire and also in correction setting, is look, the employer has the right, if it chooses, to insist that every individual be able to perform the essential functions of the job. And that, in the context of fire protection, would be engaging in fire suppression activities. In the context of law enforcement, it would be making a forcible arrest and doing many of the things that Scott, in this case, couldn't do. Courts have said employers have the right to insist on that, particularly in the case of emergencies where you have an all-hands-on-deck sort of situation. And that means there is no obligation to create a permanent light-duty job or to continue an employee in a permanent light duty job, even if they've been doing the work successfully in the past. Now, might there be a different answer if the employee, Scott in this case, had a different prognosis? If the prognosis were that she would be able to come back to work in a month or two or 10 or whatever it might be, if we were not looking at a permanent disability? I think so. I think courts might answer that differently. I think looking at the facts of this case, I think Chief Craig might have answered it differently, might have been willing to make the accommodation. But that's not what this case was about. This case was about a permanent light duty job, and courts are not willing to make public safety agencies either create or continue permanent light duty jobs as a requirement under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Now, is all this stuff negotiable? Sure. Light duty is a mandatory subject of bargaining every place I've ever seen it litigated. Could the union negotiate for permanent light duty jobs? Sure. If it had that as a priority, it certainly could. All I'm talking about here is what the ADA requires. Now for the COVID-19 link. I had a situation, or I heard about a situation yesterday involving one of our clients who I won't name, where we had an employee who was not diagnosed with COVID-19, but this employee was in fact diagnosed as being immunocompromised. She has some sort of condition, I don't know what it is, where her immune system is compromised. When the COVID-19 pandemic struck, the employer's initial reaction in this situation was to have anybody who could telecommute. So if whatever the individual's job was lended itself to telecommuting, that's what the employees would be doing. And this employee was one of the individuals who was allowed to telecommute. And in fact, she did so successfully. Well, after a couple of months of all of that happening, the police chief changed his mind and decided no more telecommuting in this agency. And if someone is not able to report to work, then they're going to have to be off on sick leave or somehow account for their time, perhaps through using up vacation time or comp time or annual leave or whatever it might be. So think about this. This is an interesting situation, right? This is somebody who's asymptomatic entirely. She doesn't have any symptoms. But if you put her into the work environment of the station where she's working around a lot of other people, her underlying physical condition, the fact that she's immunocompromised, subjects her to far greater risk than anybody else who is working alongside her. Is the ADA implicated by that? Well, here's how you go through those problems. With the ADA, the first thing you have to ask is this person disabled? And that means, do they have a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities? And the answer here clearly, I think, is yes, right? If you're immunocompromised, you have a physical condition that limits one or more major life activities. Those are all sorts of things that she can't do because she's immunocompromised. That means because she's got a disability, the employer has to reasonably accommodate her. What's the reasonable accommodation here? Pretty clear, right? She's been doing it. You allow her to telecommute. Well, but what about that Scott versus City of Detroit case I just talked about? Well, in this case, the accommodation is a temporary one, right? It ends when when the pandemic is under control. So she's not asking for a permanent light duty job. She's not asking for permanent telecommuting. What she's basically saying is, look, for as long as the pandemic is out there, I want to keep doing my job. I don't want to be off on sick leave. You know, I really committed to this department and I want to do my job, and I can do it by telecommuting, and I don't need this accommodation forever. I think that employee's got a pretty good claim under the ADA. It's different than that of Officer Scott in Detroit. I want to shift gears right now and talk about something that's not really technically a labor issue, but if you are a longtime listener to this podcast, you know I've really got a bee under my bonnet about what's known as the firefighter's rule. Sometimes it's called the professional rescuer rule. And we have a new decision out of the Utah Supreme Court involving a firefighter that deals with this rule. Let's talk about it, and I'll tell you why I have a problem with this rule. So what this rule is, broadly speaking, is a rule that says that professional rescuers, firefighters and police officers, cannot bring lawsuits against those whose conduct has injured them. They're unlike all other employees. If Mark Fuller, who works for LRIS, If I send Mark Fuller to the store, to the office supply store to pick up some equipment, and he gets injured on the way, someone clobbers him in a car, he can sue that person. But under the firefighter's rule, I'll call it the firefighter's rule, although it's also called the professional rescuer's rule. Under the firefighter's rule, if Mark was a firefighter or a police officer and got sent to the store by a supervisor and got clobbered by that same car, he couldn't sue them. And this is a rule that has been around. It dates from the early 1900s. First decision on it came out of the Illinois Supreme Court. Originally, this rule was grounded in a theory that is known as premises liability. Nobody who has not been forced to take the bar exam cares what premises liability is. But for the few of you who do, premises liability was a system where landowners or land occupiers, renters, owed different degrees of care to individuals depending upon whether the individual was an invitee, a licensee, or a trespasser on the land. Those were three different statuses. And this was a feature not just of early law in this country. It actually goes back to the 1600s, 1700s in Great Britain. So that tells you how relevant it is. Well, by the mid-20th century, courts were in the process of discarding many of these premises liability notions as just being unworkable and not really having applicability in an environment where we had, you know, electricity or something like that. Somehow or another, the firefighter's rule managed to live on, even with courts making decisions that effectively ended notions of premises liability. You had courts finding other justifications for the firefighter's rule. And the primary justification was that firefighters, police officers, when they take their jobs, they assume the risk of injury being caused to them by third persons on the job. Now, the firefighter's rule has a lot of different flavors. It is a creation of the courts in various states, and so it has a lot of different formulations depending upon what state you're in. In some places, the firefighter rule bars all lawsuits. In some other states, it bars lawsuits only against people who called for the particular service that the firefighter or the law enforcement officer was rendering. And there's just gradations all over the place as to what the firefighter's rule is. There's not a single firefighter's rule. Well, I brought you up to the 1950s. Let me bring you to the end of the 20th century. We saw a spate, a little one, I'll confess, a little spate in the late 20th century of some courts and state legislatures beginning to question the underpinning of the firefighter's rule. And they were asking these sorts of questions. Why should firefighters and law enforcement officers be treated differently than any other employee when it came to bringing lawsuits for on-the-job injuries? How does that possibly make sense? Why is it that we say that a firefighter or a police officer assumes the risk of certain types of injuries where other employees who frequently interact with the public and are out on the streets, we say they don't assume the risks of their job? And so what we saw were a few state courts deciding to abandon the rules. One of the first, may even have been the first, I'm not sure, was our Supreme Court in Oregon in a case called Christensen versus Murphy, where in 1984, the Oregon Supreme Court said, this is just a rule that has completely outlived its rationale. By the way, a disclosure, I represented the law enforcement officer in Christensen versus Murphy, so I'm really happy about the way that case came out. Other state courts reached the same decision, saying, you know, we created this rule. We can modify it. We can end it. And it doesn't make sense anymore. Some legislatures stepped in, and state legislatures can always define what is or isn't a civil cause of action in their states. And some legislatures, like New York, for example, and New Jersey, either statutorily modified the rule or repealed it entirely. However, a majority of states in this country still adhere, I almost said cling, to the firefighters' rule, even though it may be a legal principle that's no longer sound. So that's the firefighters' rule. What's this Utah case all about? And the Utah case is about the scope of the firefighters' rule. What sort of lawsuits does the firefighters' rule prohibit? And the Utah Supreme Court had really addressed the issue only once in the past in any significant way, and it was in the context of a negligence lawsuit, where the firefighter was bringing a lawsuit for saying that the individual who injured them did not act in accordance with the care that a reasonable person should. So it was a negligence, a pure negligence lawsuit. Well, this case involved a mulch fire that occurred on the property that was on property that was owned by an outfit called Diamond Tree Experts. Apparently, they were tree experts, but they weren't mulch experts. In the week before the mulch fire, there had been at least two other fires on the property. And 10 days before the mulch fire, a representative from the Salt Lake County Health Department told Diamond Tree that the mulch on its property was piled too high and the mulch needed to be reduced. What did Diamond Tree do in response to any of this? Nothing. And at the time of the fire, it knew it was in violation of several ordinances, including both the fire code and industry standards regarding the safe storage of mulch. When the fire happened, one of the firefighters who responded was a fellow named David Ipson. When working by the fire engine, he was away from the fire. A thick cloud of smoke and embers engulfed him, leaving him unable to breathe. Ipson sustained severe and permanent injuries and is now permanently disabled from returning to his job as a firefighter. Ipson sued Diamond Tree. He sued them for gross negligence and intentional harm. Okay, what's gross negligence? Gross negligence, as opposed to garden variety negligence, or simple negligence, as it's sometimes called. Gross negligence is conduct that is wholly out of keeping with the sort of care that we expect people in our society to observe. Put another way, it's really, really, really negligent negligence. And intentional harm, Ipson is saying, they are responsible for intentionally violating these codes and everything, and that resulted in my injury. I have a little problem whether or not that's a legally sound theory in these facts, but nonetheless, that's what those are the claims that he made. In the trial court, Diamond Tree filed a motion for summary judgment saying, we owe no duty to Ipson because of the firefighters' rule. Even if we were grossly negligent, even if our conduct was intentional, we owe no duty to him. And the trial court agreed, looked at that old Utah Supreme Court precedent, and dismissed Ipson's claim. And that case ends up with the Utah Supreme Court. And the Utah Supreme Court puts a box around negligence and says the firefighters' rule only applies to simple negligence, not to gross negligence. And I'm going to read you a few sentences in the court's opinion because it tells you how it is these courts justify the firefighters' rule and how the court in this case decided that something different should happen with respect to gross negligence and intentional conduct. So here are the court's words. The general rule is that we all have a duty to exercise care when engaging in affirmative conduct that creates a risk of physical harm to others. We have held that, based on public policy, a person does not owe a duty of care to a professional rescuer for injury that was sustained by the very negligence that occasioned the rescuer's presence. And that was within the scope of hazards inherent in the rescuer's duties. There's that implied assumption of risk notion just coming through in the court's description. Back to the court. We explained that the public policy underlying this exception, I know you're waiting with bated breath here, what could it be, is that firefighters and police officers have a relationship with the public that calls on them to confront certain hazards as a part of their professional responsibilities. The question we must answer today is whether the policies that supports a duty carve-out for professional rescuer suits for injuries stemming from negligence also supports a carve-out for gross negligence and intentional torts. And the court says the answer to that is no. And the reason, the court says, is that the basis for the firefighter's rule was that, and I'm quoting, negligent people might be reluctant to call professional rescuers if they knew they could be liable for the rescuer's resulting injuries. Let me pause for a moment there. Really? You're the victim of a crime, or there's a fire blazing on your property, and you are not going to pick up the phone and call 911 because you're afraid that the firefighter or a police officer is going to be injured, and B, they'll sue you for negligence, and C, that your insurance won't cover it? Really? When I'm telling you courts stretch for a rationale for the firefighter's rule, this is a great example of it. Okay, but back to the court. The way the court ends this opinion is just precious. But because people who act with gross negligence or intentionally are an order or two of magnitude more culpable than those who act negligently, they are unlikely to call professional rescuers in the first place. Here goes the court. Imagine the emergency call, 911. I was utterly callous about setting or deliberately set my neighbor's house on fire. I'd like to report myself. Pure fantasy. Well, really, I mean, the whole logic behind the rule is kind of pure fantasy. But bottom line is, the court says, we're not going to extend this firefighter's rule beyond the scope of pure negligent cases. And firefighter Ipsen, he gets to continue with his lawsuit. Next, I want to give you a quick read on the latest Janus case on dues deduction. And this is one of a series of cases that's being brought or supported by the Right to Work Foundation in Virginia. As I've mentioned before in these podcasts, the nonprofits that brought us Janus, they haven't given up. Their aim is for an end to unions, public sector unions, period. They say it up front. That's what they're interested in. So their victory in Janus was, for them, not the end point of a journey, but a waypoint along the journey. And so one of the things that they are claiming in these series of lawsuits, and there's now dozens of them around the United States, one of the things they're claiming is that anybody who is a member of the union has the right to revoke their membership at any time. And that argument is not getting a good reception from the courts. And this latest case, which comes out of Pennsylvania, federal court in Pennsylvania, is a good example of it. This is not a police or fire case. This involves SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, Local 668. It represents about 130 employees in Lehigh County. The collective bargaining agreement between the union and the county provides that members can resign from their membership from the union during a period of 15 days prior to the expiration of the contract. And this case comes up because an employee by the name of Molina indicated that he wanted to resign from the union. Mid-contract, July 20, 2018, the union gets a letter from him saying, well, I want to resign. Interestingly enough, less than a month later, he's fired. So we're only talking about dues here that last for, by my count, about 24 days. And Molina said to the union, I want them back because I resigned from the union. And the union saying, no, you know, when you signed on, you signed a dues authorization card. And when you signed that dues authorization card, you agreed that the authorization, quoting, shall be irrevocable for a period of 1 year or until the termination of the applicable collective bargaining agreement, whichever occurs sooner. And so you're stuck. You owe us those dues for those 24 days or whatever they might be. So Molina sues, brings a federal court lawsuit over 24 days of union dues. How much could that possibly have been? These groups supporting these employees are very, very well funded. You know, when you have donors with the last name of Koch, you got a lot of money that you can spend in pursuit of whatever this might be, $43.22. I don't know. I totally made up that number. So the issue before the court is whether or not there's anything in Janus that allows Molina to immediately resign his membership. That's the position that Molina and his lawyers are arguing. And the court rejects it. I'm going to read you four or five sentences here. The court says, the undisputed facts show that Molina joined the union, signed a dues deduction authorization, and remained a member until resigning his membership in 2018. Because Molina was a member of the union when his dues were deducted, Janus is inopposite. Molina's argument that the animating principle of Janus should be extended to union members is unavailing. The Supreme Court's reasoning in Janus was that a law requiring a non-union member to pay fees to support a union is compelled speech. Thus, the animating principle of Janus was not that the payment of union dues violates the First Amendment, but rather that compelling non-union members to support a union by paying fees violates the First Amendment. So the court says here what many other courts have said when faced with this same issue. When you sign a dues authorization card, you got a contract. Contract between the union and the employee. And both sides voluntarily entered into that contract. We, the federal courts, are not going to be in the position of tearing up those contracts, and those contracts simply don't violate anybody's constitutional rights. Next up, we've got a fascinating case out of Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission involving the status quo rule. The status quo rule exists whenever you've got a collective bargaining relationship. And what it says is that an employer is obligated to maintain past practices that concern mandatory subjects of bargaining. An employer cannot make a unilateral change in past practice under the status quo rule unless it first negotiates to impasse through whatever the impasse resolution mechanism is with the union. It's kind of a past practice notion. And like I said, it exists really wherever there's collective bargaining. The Supreme Court of the United States once described it in a case that's known as Katz. We now know this, that case is creating the Katz doctrine. But The simple statement of it is, if something is mandatory for bargaining, the employer may not change the status quo, may not change the past practice in that area without first negotiating with the union. So what's this case in Washington about? In 2017, the Washington legislature creates a Paid Family Medical Leave Act. So it's kind of like the FMLA, only employees get some paid time. And the act funded the program in part through premiums of 0.4% of each employee's salary. And the act provided, and I'm quoting, an employer may deduct, end quote, the premium from the wages of employees. All right, so this dispute boils up in Whatcom County, and it involves the county and the Whatcom County Deputy Sheriff's Guild. They're parties to a collective bargaining agreement that runs through the end of 2019. So this family leave law becomes effective during the term of the contract. And of course, the collective bargaining agreement doesn't address the issue of premiums called for by the Family Leave Act, because the Family Leave Act didn't exist at the time the collective bargaining agreement started. The county makes an announcement that it intends to deduct the employee portion of the contribution, 0.4%, from the employee's paychecks, effective January 4th, 2019. The guild says, whoa, wait a minute, we want to bargain over that decision. Don't change the past practice. The parties end up meeting. They're meeting about another issue, but they end up talking about this. The county doesn't change its mind. The guild doesn't change its mind. The county unilaterally implements the deduction from employee wages, and the guild files an unfair labor practice against the county. And the heart of the unfair labor practice is a claim that the employer violated the past practice rule by starting these deductions. So the real question, if you think about it in this case, is what exactly is the status quo here? And that, in fact, is what the Public Employee Relations Commission, Public Employment Relations Commission in Washington, has to focus on. I'll call it PERC, because that's what everybody knows it as. And here's what PERC has to say. The union has the burden of proving the status quo, PERC says. And the term status quo refers to what you can think of as the existing collective bargaining relationship between the parties. What does that mean? What's an existing collective bargaining relationship? Well, the relationship really involves two sets of rights. One is that bundle of rights that is contained in the collective bargaining agreement. The other are all these other rights that are mandatory subjects of bargaining that the contract doesn't cover, that are protected by the status quo rule. All right, so back to what PERC has to say, and now I'm going to start quoting. Here, before the employer began deducting partial family leave premiums from their wages, employees received their full pay as set out in the collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, the wages the parties had negotiated in the collective bargaining agreement were the status quo. Interesting, right? Yeah, we can all agree that the wages were the status quo. What PERC doesn't really delve into all that much is, does that mean the status quo refers to gross wages? Because if it's gross wages, then the employer did nothing wrong here. But if it's net wages after the deductions were taken, then the employer did something wrong. And even though PERC doesn't use those terms, that's really at the heart of what PERC is saying. Okay, back to the act. And you'll see that when I, excuse me, back to the PERC's decision. And you'll see that rationale when I read you the next few sentences here. Negotiable wages broadly encompasses every form of compensation for labor performed, including alternative forms of compensation such as insurance. Employee contributions to family and medical leave premiums are similar to employee contributions to health and other insurance premiums. Employees through their unions must agree to divert wages to these other benefits. The deduction of premiums reduces employees' wages and therefore is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Well, the employer says, wait a minute. You remember the act? And the act that used that language, the specific language, an employer may deduct the premium from the wages of employees. Doesn't that give us the right to do so? And Perk says, nope. Quoting again, the statute permits employers to pay the entirety of the premiums or to share them with employees by percentages up to a maximum of 0.4%. Nowhere in the statute does the legislature suggest that public employers with represented employees could treat the statutory maximum deduction as what the employer terms here a statutory default split and deduct that amount from employees' wages. So Perk is really saying a couple of things there. First of all, what Perk is saying is there's not a mandate in this statute that 0.4% be deducted from employees' wages. Rather, that is a permissible outcome. But there are other possible outcomes. It could well be, for example, that employers could choose to pay the entire premium or something in between. All those are permissible. And therefore, this statute is not mandatory. Second thing Perk is saying, and it's sub rosa again, it's something that you don't see in the opinion itself, but I think it's at the heart of it, is if we are going to see in another statute, like this family leave statute, if we're going to see a waiver of the right of unions to bargain about it from the legislature, we want to see that waiver specifically articulated in the statute. We want to see something like, without regard to its collective bargaining obligations, the employer shall deduct 0.4% of salary to pay for family and medical leave premiums. If we don't see something that specific, we are not going to impute, as part of legislative intent, a waiver of the right to bargain. And Perk ends its opinion by requiring the county to make employees whole for all premiums that it deducted from the employees' wages. Well, that's it for this month's regular First Thursday. Remember the other First Thursday, where I talk about some much more difficult things than I think any of these cases really discuss. Reminder, we're now accepting pre-orders for the 8th edition of the Rights of Law Enforcement Officers book. We're in the process of final edits, and it'll be printed and be available for shipping by the end of the summer, for sure. It is right now 601 pages and it is chock full of footnote goodness for anybody who's looking for recent cases concerning the rights of law enforcement officers in the workplace. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.